This is KYRS Spokane LPFM. Local Heroes is pre-recorded. This is Local Heroes, a show celebrating the people of Spokane, the folks who make us unique, and the surprising stories they have to share. Join me as we hear from the neighbors who enrich our lives. I'm Barbara Baumgarten. One love, one heart. Let's get together and feel all right. Hear the children crying. One love. Hear the children. My guest today is Tim Connor, a Spokane journalist and environmentalist, currently working for the Sierra Club on the Spokane River and Aquifer Project, and formerly an investigative reporter for Camas Magazine. Thanks for coming, Tim.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Yes. Why did you decide to get into investigative journalism?
I guess it kind of runs in the family. In a way, my grandmother and my uncle were involved in newspapering. My uncle just retired as the editorial page editor of the Boulder Camera and actually still writes a column for the Denver Post. And I think, you know, it also had to do with the era I grew up in or came of age in.
What do you mean?
Well, I remember being very engaged as a teenager in the Watergate story and the work that Woodward and Bernstein and others were doing to bring that to light. It was kind of interesting because I was actually living in overseas at the time. I grew up in the Panama Canal Zone where my grandfather and father worked for the Panama Canal Company. My grandfather on my father's side was a blaster. He actually piloted a drill boat on the canal, and my dad was a school teacher. My dad was actually in the Army Reserves at the time. So the household I was growing up in was pretty conventional, pretty patriotic. So for the work of journalists unseating a president by bringing the truth to light about a scandal such as Watergate was really interesting to me, given all the deference that we were told to give to the government in what at the time was in the Canal Zone was basically a big government company town. Mm-hmm. And there were certainly issues there with regard to free speech and journalism, as you would expect in any militaristic company town. So I don't know. I just really was excited by that process. The whole idea of what it meant to be an American and what things like the Constitution meant, this was living evidence of just how powerful our principles are, not necessarily how powerful our government is.
Were your folks also involved? Was this really important to them, too?
I think it was really troubling for my mother. My mom and dad live here in Spokane, and they've been big supporters of my work throughout my career. And I think their political educations and leanings have changed over time. I think they're more progressive and liberal today than they were then. But given that place and time, a high premium was put on patriotism. Again, mm-hmm. This was, you know, back during the Vietnam War. We were in an enclave in the middle of another country where our whole identity and reason for being was very much tied up in some notions, some would say misguided notions about what patriotism was all about.
Did you take that up for yourself as well at the time?
Yeah, I was kind of imbued. I was a football player, and some of the strongest memories from my youth are standing on the sidelines listening to the national anthem being played, and the, mm-hmm. you know, there was the whole pageantry of that. It was all swept together. I grew up surrounded by military bases. Most of my friends were military kids. So there was a lot there. But I also should say I had good teachers, good history teachers and civics teachers in the school system there that taught me the benefits of being skeptical, of asking questions. And I began to write. I began writing for my high school paper and my junior college paper. And before I left the zone, was actually in trouble for work I was doing with a paper called Deviled Ham, which was the newspaper for the community college I went to.
And you were in trouble because?
I was doing reporting on some labor problems at the time. There was a lot of tumult. The canal was in the process of, the Panama Canal Treaty at the time, and it was tied in with a lot of labor negotiations. My journalism, as it were, wasn't that revolutionary. I was just simply giving voices to people that weren't getting their voices heard on some issues. But that got me in a little bit of hot water with the governor.
And where did that come from,
desire to give people a voice who didn't have a voice?
I was just beginning to learn what journalism was. I mean, to me, I've always been guided by my own curiosity. Ideas that interested me that I thought needed more discussion, I would try to go out and do that. That's what I thought journalists did. I remember doing one of the stories that got me in trouble early was learning about an asbestos problem at a school lunch cafeteria. Actually, it was a huge edifice called a cafetorium where there was literally asbestos coming loose on the roof and raining down on lunch tables.
Wow.
And digging into that at the time was stressful. This was a company town. There wasn't really a role for that kind of reporting, even from student journalists.
So would you say then that your curiosity really guided you to your belief systems, that your belief systems didn't really guide your curiosity? Because you came from, like you said, a conservative home in the military, and that's not where you are now for sure.
Well, you know, it's a really interesting question because as conservative as our patriotism was, it was always wrapped around this notion of freedom and the freedom to question. And that's the part of it I like the most. And through the connection I was developing with my uncle and his work in the States, he was managing editor at the time for the Eugene Register Guard, which was a fine newspaper. He had assigned his investigative reporter to follow up on the murder of Don Bowles, who was an investigative reporter with the Arizona Republic, who had begun to report on the mob, and his car was blown up. And my uncle was affronted. And he helped put together a group that became investigative reporters and editors, which is a part of the journalism establishment now, but it was created around that episode because the editors and reporters in America were not going to have the mob or anybody else taking out reporters for doing their jobs.
Mm-hmm. Seems like we still have the same problems today.
I think our problems are bigger today. I think journalism is a dying profession in many ways, and I'm very troubled by that. I think at the time that I was coming of age as a reporter, this was a profession that was on the rise in terms of its standards, its expectations, and frankly, its esteem. I mean, to me, there were valid reasons to aspire to be a good reporter, with the understanding that that was such an important role and how you could have good government and good democracy, good public participation.
So how do you deal with the decline of that now?
I'm real conflicted by it. I don't know. It affects me with a genuine sadness, and I hope this time we're going through is short-lived, and I hope that it's simply a trend that will turn around. But it's hard to be optimistic when you look at the way the media and reporters are organized to feed themselves. I mean, we depend as much as ever on advertisers and commercial money to fund what is almost inherently not commercial work. I mean, the search for the truth, because of the role that the truth has to play in democracy, cannot be tied to commercial interests, and yet our media is primarily and predominantly funded by commercial interests, and radio stations like this and public broadcasting has a role to play in that. But I think most of my peers would agree that it's an imperfect solution. We've got some long-standing structural issues in journalism that are not being well addressed, and we're suffering as a result of it.
And how do you deal with it personally? What do you do in terms of your work and your life to give it meaning when you feel like the meaning of the profession is getting lost?
It's really painful. I mean, I've understood. I mean, my last term as an investigative reporter with Canvas Magazine was done at considerable expense to my family and the family of Larry Shook and Judy Ladin, who were the editors and publishers of Canvas, along with me.
How is that so?
Well, because we had begun publishing after being invited in that situation by people in the Spokane community who said they were interested in funding our work and putting up the money to do a commercial project. As soon as we started doing the River Park Square story, all that funding dried up. And so we basically had to fund that project on our credit cards and out of, you know, my case, my wife's ability to work and have an income so that I could do my work essentially for free was important to that. And I loved my work, and I loved what I was trying to do for the community, but I can't do it anymore because I can't get paid to do it. Nobody in Spokane will pay me to do the work that I was doing at Canvas Magazine, even though it won several national journalism awards.
That is sad, isn't it?
Well, it's sad, too, that my colleague who worked for the ABC affiliate in Spokane, Tom Grant, was essentially exiled to Wyoming because of the work we did together. He was unable to get and hold a job in Spokane as a journalist, even though he narrowly lost the mayor's race. So I have tremendous pain and sadness. There are days where I allow myself a few minutes to sit at my desk and sob. It breaks my heart some days that I can't do the work that I want to do in my community. You know, I just hope that's temporary. I hope that I'll always be able to do journalism, and I hope to be doing journalism in Spokane at some time in the future.
Why do you stay then? I mean, the feeling of betrayal must be huge. So why wouldn't you move somewhere else and do your work?
Well, I have family here. Both my parents and my wife's parents. My wife's mother lives here now. My kids are growing up here and going to schools here. I've always loved Spokane for reasons that have nothing to do with its journalism. I love it for the same reason the fur trading companies had difficulty getting people out of Spokane 100 years ago or 120 years ago after they moved here. It was because they just liked the natural setting. I was born in Eastern Washington. I just like it here.
Now, you say you love your work. What is it that you love most about it? What's the most meaningful part of your work for you?
Well, as a journalist, I like what journalists do. I mean, there's several levels of what it means to do journalism. Some of it, you know, we're taught at the earliest rudimentary stage how to cover a burglary or how to cover a car crash. You know, one of my first stories was covering Mount St. Helens. I was in Ellensburg, you know, my first newspaper job when the mountain blew. Running around in a dust cloud with the sheriff, seeing people in distress, writing stories, taking pictures. There's some people that are just born to love that sort of thing. I've always been drawn to investigative reporting because I've had mentors who've really instilled in me that the best journalism you can do is to get at the truths that the powerful want to keep from the people. And again, that, you know, that goes back to being influenced by Watergate. I guess I'm also attracted to it because it's difficult and it really requires focus and balance, adrenaline.
Is that what makes it difficult?
Well, the adrenaline makes it easier. Well, you know, part of what makes it difficult, I mean, I'm not the life of the party by any means. I'm not the world's biggest extrovert, but I genuinely like people. As a beat reporter, if I go meet somebody at a window or desk, I really enjoy being pleasant and engaging people. It's just easier to move through life that way. Being an investigative reporter, you have to accept that people are not going to be necessarily amused or warm to you when you're trying to do your job. That's a real challenge, you know, as somebody who was raised in a strong Christian household with a very loving mother, very outgoing, to be able to manage your natural instincts to be warm and engaging to people with the obligation you have to push through the veneer of that human relationship to get what your readers need to know. You're not doing the world any good if you're failing to ask the right questions, pursue the right story, because you don't want people to think that you're a bad guy or that you're mean or that you're not on their side. So, you know, that's part of what makes, for me, doing investigative reporting not difficult, but challenging. I've got to balance both personas. I've got to balance my compassion and my joy as a human being with my duty to go out and ask hard questions and even sue people if it's necessary in order to do my job.
The passion for the purpose gets to be more profound than the need to be liked.
It's a good way of measuring yourself. I thought the last story I did, even though I'm really proud of the work I did before River Park Square, I think I got at the truth of River Park Square, and I felt really good that we got it right, and that it was important for the community to get it right. And so,
why was it important for the community? How did you see that?
It's important for Spokane to know how its decisions are made and who makes those decisions. And in this situation where you had the city's most powerful family, the publishing family, the Coles family, coming to the city to do a, quote, public-private partnership, in which many of the most important parts of that partnership were being purposely withheld from the public to protect the politicians who wanted to do the project. In other words, the fear was that if the public knew the extent to which the public coin was being put at risk to do this project, that there would have been more of a popular uprising than there already was. It was fundamental to me that people in Spokane know that story, that the people of Spokane know what Betsy Coles asked of the city, and the people in Spokane know what people like Roberta Green, Phyllis Holmes, Orville Barnes, their elected leaders did in response to that. This also was important for me in a later phase of the story for people to know what Laurel Sitaway, the city special counsel, was doing with the evidence of complicity and culpability on the part of public officials. We have a long-standing problem in Spokane of not doing government well. I mean, we're suffering through one of our worst crises right now, you know, with the West scandal and so forth. So it's just a continual problem in Spokane for government to be healthy, for people to have confidence that the people that they have elected or the people they've been given the choices to elect are really doing their bidding and not the bidding of somebody else.
Mm-hmm. My guest today is Tim Connor, a Spokane journalist and environmentalist, currently working for the Sierra Club on the Spokane River and Aquifer Project, and formerly an investigative reporter for Camas Magazine. Now, you were talking before about the challenge of being an investigative reporter, having to make the truth primary in what you're doing, and sometimes people get angry at you, and that's not an easy thing to deal with. And I'm wondering how you got through it and what you had to go through to make peace with that.
Certainly one of the turning points for both Tom Grant and I in the River Park Square story was when John Powers was elected mayor on a campaign promise of accountability. And within months it became clear that the Powers administration wasn't so much interested in accountability but of selling a version of the River Park Square story that certainly in the view of Tom and I, who had been the investigative reporters breaking the story, was false, because what John and his special counsel, Laurel Sitaway, were arguing essentially is that the city had acted honorably and was in fact only duped by the Coles family. Well, by that time, we'd had the sources, and we would eventually have the documents that the mayor and his special counsel were withholding from us at that time to show just how much these city officials knew at that time. They were trying to protect them. We knew that they were complicit. It was odd because, in a way, Tom and I were agreeing with Betsy Coles and her lawyers, because their part of their defense, of course, was, "What do you mean we duped you? You were in you were at the table. You knew you were." They didn't put it this way, but they were capitulating. They were knowingly capitulating to these demands in secret meetings, and that's all come out. That is part of the record that, unfortunately, you won't read in the Spokesman Review or the Inlander. But that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
That was very difficult, because suddenly Tom and I became under attack, essentially, by the Powers administration and their supporters for our work. You know, we were getting muscled and shoved into trying to distort, basically being told that we were getting the story wrong because it wasn't the story that John and Powers and Laurel Sitaway wanted to tell. That was difficult, and it still is.
What do you mean it still is?
I think it's still unclear to people in Spokane as to what that strategy involved. The city has never officially acknowledged the wrongdoing and the complicity of city officials in this fraud. Now, fraud, small f, just in terms of misleading the public as to what was going on, there's no question that a fraud occurred there and that public officials were morally and perhaps legally culpable for that.
You chose to tell the truth. You chose to present the facts and to do your job. And to do it well.
Well, to not back down and not say, yeah, I'm going to accept your version of this because it serves your legal strategy.
So what did you go through? I mean, in a sense, you didn't back down because you were doing what you believed was right. Yet at the same time, you were under attack and you were jeopardizing your future in terms of your work.
Well,
how did you deal with that?
I don't think it mattered as to the future. I think what was jeopardized in the future of our work was the general timidity of Spokane media and its ownership. You know, the Coles family still owns the paychecks of most of the reporters in town, and there was just no way that I was ever going to go to work for the Coles family after, you know, exposing the way they had interacted with City Hall and River Park Square. So by that time, certainly I had no illusions about being able to work that much longer in Spokane as a journalist. I did want to get it right. I wanted people to know what had really happened. I thought that's what it was all about. The people that we elected that were sitting at the table with her and her negotiators cutting these deals worked for us. We were paying them. They had enormous public trust put in them. I was determined up until the last to try to hold them accountable. All I could control was my work with my editors and try to do the best I can. So that's what I focused on.
Mm-hmm. And what are you focusing on now?
Well, I've gotten a new job with the Sierra Club. I work part-time for the Sierra Club trying to clean up our wonderful river. It's interesting. My career has kind of gone back and forth between journalism and environmentalism, which I guess is understandable. I mean, I got into covering the Hanford Nuclear Reservation as an investigative reporter and wound up working for years for the Hanford Education Action League on environmental issues related to nuclear weapons production. And that's the first time, I guess, I changed hats and went from being a reporter to a journalist. So right now I'm trying to use what I do best as a researcher and an advocate to help educate people in Spokane about what's at stake with the river and what we need to do to clean it up. And one of the things I've done recently, which is out on the newsstands now, is my last River Park Square article for the time being, which is a piece that I did for Washington Law and Politics called Trouble in River City, which is really about the story of Old Yale Lewis, the attorney that was brought in from Seattle back in 2000 to be the city's first special counsel. Mr. Lewis had been important in setting up the Pike Place market in Seattle, and it was thought that his expertise with these public-private partnerships would help him get to the bottom of what had gone or what was beginning to go wrong at River Park Square. And so what makes his story interesting is he'd come in, and just when he was getting to the point where what had really happened was starting to unfold before him, he was basically told his services were no longer necessary, and he was sent back to Seattle, where he's a very successful lawyer in Seattle. He represents, for among others, the family of Jimi Hendrix. Courtney Love is another one of his clients. So he's got a successful practice there. But he was really hooked on Spokane. His experience here and his time here and what he learned really shook him. The story kind of follows him through that, to his disappointment that the people of Spokane not only didn't really get to know everything about the story, but really were asked to pay for it. So that's on the newsstands now. I think people might find it interesting. There's also a sidebar on the ongoing West scandal that's in there.
It must feel to you like you've been, you know, working on this for quite a while, working hard, and somehow people are not getting it.
Yeah, I think that's probably a lot of it. And I think part of the reason I wanted to use Yale's experience, Lewis's experience, is that that was his frustration as well. As a journalist, ultimately, yeah, I would really have liked it if people in Spokane understood the story better. It is disappointing that that didn't happen. You can never get too wedded, and you shouldn't get wedded to results that you're reporting. You shouldn't be too hopeful that in getting a story right that somebody's going to come forth on a white horse and make everything right. I mean, that's...
Well, that makes sense intellectually, but emotionally, we have to live with these things. And I don't know that they make sense that way. And I just imagine that must be part of the sadness that you feel even to this day, that it didn't have the kind of impact that you wanted it to have.
Well, you know, it's tempered in an interesting way because, of course, when you look at whatever I've learned and whatever grief I've experienced trying to do River Park Square, look at the fiasco the country is about because of the way bad reporting helped get us into a war. I mean, I don't think anybody can reasonably argue now that we're in Iraq on the right pretenses. There's no argument that newspapers like the New York Times were gullible, almost unconscionably gullible, to reporting things that were not true. One of my friends from my activism work is David Albright, who was a former weapons inspector in Iraq. I got to know David through his work with Federation of American Scientists because he was a nuclear expert there. And David and I actually went and lobbied Strom Thurmond together one day with Connie Raybuck, who I since married. And I got to know David well. Well, David was trying to alert Judith Miller at the New York Times and other reporters to the chicanery with the facts of the Iraq war, specifically the uranium issue with the tubes, the aluminum tubes, that turns out to have been one of the bogus reasons we used to go to war. And so when I lie in bed at night and worry about River Park Square, it's really tempered by the perspective that there are other journalists whose reporting really has made a life and death issue for people in every one of our 50 states. As somebody who still considers himself primarily a journalist at heart and someone who cares passionately about journalism, it's been interesting to watch that unfold and say, well, you know, it's not just me. I'm not the only one who has to struggle with these questions and the consequences of good reporting versus bad reporting.
When I hear you talk about the experiences that you've had in Spokane that I think would disappoint anyone, you could give it up, I guess. You know, where is your place here? You know, I can imagine that there would be a lot of internal questioning and wondering about what to do next, to stay with what you're doing and to continue to use your passion in that way. And I just wonder about that internal struggle. I could imagine having it for myself, and it would not be an easy one. And I wonder what it's like for you and what some of the thoughts or feelings you have about where you move next with your life.
That's a great question. Well, you know, my mother's wonderful, and she's a deeply spiritual woman, and she has always been there for me. She's always prayed to help my work and help me do my work. And my mother has, ever since I've known her, struggled with debilitating arthritis. She has to work her way through quite a bit of physical pain just to live and bring joy and love to 6 children.
6 children?
She had 6 kids.
Where were you in that?
I'm number 2. We're just about to celebrate my older sister's 50th birthday, so that'll be cool. But you know, this is not all about me, as my wife would like to say. I mean, I'm only accountable to do the best that I can. And I really understood that in the 5 years that I was doing River Park Square, I was doing it with the support and blessings of my family. As you get to be, if I get further along as a husband and a father, I realize that I'm more and more in the process of being faithful to them. I mean, these are the people that have helped me do my work, and they let me do my work as passionately as well as I could. That's all I could reasonably ask. I can't ask for a Pulitzer Prize or an audience of people that are willing to keep me in business as a reporter for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. But I can honor what they've given me to allow me to do my work. I'm still very touched. I mean, it's interesting, as bitter as I am sometimes that I can't do journalism in Spokane, Larry Shook and Judy Ladd and my colleagues at CAMAS would also agree that we've had many people come forward and support us emotionally who have a deep investment in this community. We care about them and we're loyal to them and we love them. So, you know, I do get emotional about it, but I think my job spiritually is to move on. It doesn't do me any good to sit around and be mad at people for not having this work out better. I really just try to get up and say, what can I do now where I can still make a difference for my community and my family? Mm-hmm. And that's really how I cope with it, just how I deal with it.
Well, it sounds like family is really important to you.
Well, families are formidable institutions.
Yes.
I mean, the Coles family certainly has proven its way, but so has my family. I couldn't have done my work without my family, and I know who they are, and I know the love and principle and conviction that they've invested in me and supporting me. It was part of what held this thing together and allowed me to do work that fortunately entities like the Society of Professional Journalists have recognized as being some of the best investigative reporting that's been done in recent years. So that's really cool. That's the power of family right there. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was not the power of commercial media. This was the power of families that had deep convictions about what they thought was the right thing to do for their community. I mean, there are people out there that genuinely don't like Tim Connor, Larry Shook, and Judy Ladin for the work we did because it made problems for them. But we've gotten so much back from the remainder of the community, from many others in the community who said, we would never have understood this without your work. And that's almost the most valuable gift you can give any mm-hmm. reporter, anybody who's feels passionately about journalism and the role of journalism in a healthy society.
Tim Connor, I'm glad you came today.
Thank you.
I'm glad to have heard your story.
Thank you. It was wonderful to share it.
This is Local Heroes. I'm Barbara Baumgarten.
Feel all right, saying, let's get together.